You're listening to Admitting Diagnosis, the Journal Watch podcast for the week ending July 25th. I'm Joe Elia. We offer a brief roundup of the week's essential medical news. By that, I mean news you really ought not to leave the house without knowing, plus an interview. This week, we talk with Professor Robert Hogg about his findings just published in Lancet on life expectancy with HIV in high-income countries. If you'd like to leave us a comment, and please do, call 617-440-4374. Story links are available at podcasts.jwatch.org. Okay, here are the week's essential medical stories very briefly. Guidelines, 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 and reimbursements. Now some details. Guidelines Part 1. The American Academy of Pediatrics has updated its 1998 recommendations on lipid screening in children. They recommend screening every 3 to 5 years, beginning at age 2. They also recommend weight management as the primary strategy. However, for kids 8 and older with LDL concentrations above 190, they recommend considering treatment with statins. Writing in Journal Watch Pediatrics and Adolescent Medicine, Howard Bachner says that the decision over using statins at that age, considering the concerns and preferences of patients and families, evaluating the relevant data, and acknowledging one's biases, epitomizes the art of medicine. Guidelines Part 2. The American College of Critical Care Medicine has made recommendations on the diagnosis and treatment of critical illness-related corticosteroid insufficiency. The guidelines focus on the use of glucocorticoids in patients with acute respiratory distress syndrome or septic shock. The drugs should be considered for use in patients with septic shock unresponsive to fluid resuscitation and vasopressor agents. In respiratory distress, glucocorticoids should be considered in severe disease and should be used before day 14 in patients whose disease hasn't resolved. For other diseases like pneumonia and liver failure, the task force says it needs more data. Guidelines, Part 3. Managing prediabetes? The American College of Endocrinology has some suggestions. Patients with fasting glucose values between 100 and 125 milligrams should undergo annual testing for glucose tolerance and microalbuminuria. Hemoglobin A1C, fasting glucose, and lipids should be checked every 6 months. That's right, every 6 months. There are other suggestions, all available free on the college's website. We give the link at beta.jwatch.org. And finally, if you send prescriptions to the pharmacy electronically, the government wants to express its gratitude with a 2% increase in your Medicare reimbursement starting in January. The program will continue for 5 years, at the end of which the government will start decreasing its reimbursements if you don't file those scripts electronically. If you're listening to this, I think you're covered. And here is the Journal Watch interview. Lancet has just published a paper on longevity with HIV in high-income countries where combination antiretroviral therapy is the norm. The study follows closely on another published by JAMA, finding that life expectancy in the first 5 years of HIV infection is similar to rates in the general population in high-income countries. In the Lancet paper, using cohorts from Canada, Europe, and the U.S., researchers estimated the remaining years of life in some 43,000 patients starting combination therapy at various points since 1996. They found that the years of life remaining for a 20-year-old starting therapy increased from 36 in the 1996-1999 period to almost 50 years of remaining life in the 2003-2005 period. Patients who acquired their HIV through injection drug use have a lower expectancy, as do those whose therapy was delayed until CD4 counts got very low. We've asked a principal in this research, Professor Robert Hogg, to discuss the clinical implications of all this with us. Professor Hogg is a director at the British Columbia Center for Excellence in HIV/AIDS and on the Faculty of Health Sciences at Simon Fraser University, both in Vancouver. Welcome, Professor Hogg, and thanks for talking with us today.
Oh, it's nice to be here. Thank you.
So this matter of survival with HIV has been in the news lately. Is there much more data available to analyze these days than there were, than there had been, or are people trying to come to grips with HIV's status now as a chronic disease?
I think there is. I mean, there's both. I would say to both questions, yes. I think that there's a lot more data than there was previously to answer this question, and I think there'll be a lot more analysis done over the next few years in this area. So that's certainly welcome. And I think it's also because of the nature of the disease, there's an opportunity just to understand how long people will live with the introduction of new therapies that happened about a decade ago.
And those therapies now have been, as you mentioned in the paper, those therapies have been improving. They've been more widely used. Patients are tolerating them better, and they've been changing somewhat, haven't they, over that span?
Yeah, there has been a number of changes that have occurred. I think the most important is that people become, in terms of the burden for the individual that is taking these therapies, it's certainly a lot less in terms of the pill burden, the amount of time, the amount of the frequency in terms of the dosing has also decreased as well, and also the side effects associated have changed over time. Mm-hmm. Also, understanding in terms of the experience of physicians with these medicines has also changed over time. Physicians now are much more experienced than they were in previously, and therefore able to provide patients with better care.
Were you surprised when you did the analysis to see the increase in longevity?
I was. I think we were all surprised by the numbers. I think we spent a lot of time working on this paper, actually, and so it took us a while just to get our heads around the numbers themselves. I think it was also it was nice to. There was also you mentioned a paper in JAMA, but there was also a previous paper in Denmark that came up with similar numbers. So we were pleased to see that we were on a track, and it's nice to hear about the JAMA paper as well, providing similar numbers. So that, in a sense, we seem to be all coming to the same conclusion.
Yes. In fact, when we covered the JAMA paper in Physicians First Watch a few weeks ago, somebody wrote into us and said that we hadn't emphasized enough that these results were really in the high-income countries, and that did not include most of the cases of HIV/AIDS in the world. That's tragically true, perhaps. Do you think that benefit of combination therapy is going to begin to spread around?
I think so. I think that there's also... there's Professor Matthias Egger, who's also part of the study, and also a number of the colleagues on the ART Collaborative collaboration are basically involved in a study called ART Link, and that's an opportunity. They work in sub-Saharan Africa and other low-income countries around the world. And I think there'll be an opportunity over the next little while just to see what the impact of these drugs have had on life expectancy in these countries. I think that also work that has been done by that group also shows that in terms of the why, in North America and Europe, where the physicians that do provide these drugs have a variety of different regimens that they can use, and also they have a number of second and third line regimens. The work that the ART Link group has shown and other people in this area that are involved in the IDEA network have shown that really there's very few regimens that are available in low-income countries. And so that might have an impact in terms of how long people live in these countries.
Yes. Give us a sense now of the increase in lifespan that you identified in your paper.
I think that, you have to look at it in terms of a perspective, and I think that's why it's so hard to get for us to get our heads around it in a sense from people that have been around for so long. There's a number of us in the 1980s and early 90s, people with HIV disease that were on therapy or even the natural history of HIV disease, people, their life expectancy was very short. These numbers suggest that people can live much longer. And in essence, if you look at an individual, let's say a mother in her 20s, says just has a kid who's HIV positive, right? The mother's HIV positive, the kid isn't. There's an opportunity for that mother to see that child grow until she's, you know, until early adulthood, and certainly much longer. And so from these data, and I think that's interesting, it also suggests an individual, from an individual taking heart, that it has become a much more chronic disease, and it should be managed in that sense. So we have been talking about this, in a sense, from an academic standpoint and, treating standpoint for a while, but these numbers give you a sense of just the true chronic nature of HIV disease.
So these patients now can actually begin to plan lives that look very much like the lives of people without HIV.
Yeah, these data suggest that, yeah. I mean, they're not going to live as long as a person in the general population, but they will certainly live much longer than in individuals that did not initiate heart. And certainly what you see that people in the last interval of this study, in 2003 and 2005, the difference is only about just a little more than 10 years in terms of people at age 20. So they can expect to live 10 or 11 years less.
I see. And that brings them out into the, for a 20-year-old, I think it was, that brings them close to 70 years old at this point, as a life expectancy.
So the comparable population here, just because nearly half the population in our study is from, a large majority from our study population is from France. If you look at France as the general population, the life expectancy for both males and females is around 80 years at age 20. So they're expected, as I mentioned, about 10 or 11 years less than the general population at that age.
So what kind of patient questions do you think these numbers will allow clinicians to answer?
Well, I think I think as a patient, or at least if I was someone initiating heart, I would want to know how long I have in terms of life to live. And for a physician, it gives them some sort of estimate in terms of how long a patient will live with HIV when they're on heart or CART or antiretroviral therapy. So I think that's the first thing. I think what it also suggests is that there's quite a heterogeneity in terms of the life expectancy based on CD4 cell count, gender, and also on injection drug use.
Are there levels of CD4 that that people should not wait to drop to before they're starting highly active antiretroviral therapy or these combination therapies?
I mean, it's difficult. We do have the when to start, I think, is always an interesting question from any study, if you can answer that question. Our data suggests, but certainly this study was never designed to answer that question, that starting probably later, starting earlier with higher CD4s is probably better. But the study's not really designed to do that, and we do have work by Professor Jonathan Stern and others that he's collaborated in the U.S. with, they have a paper that will hopefully be published soon in that area, or have done research in that area before.
Okay, I understand that you weren't addressing that question specifically, but I can imagine that other researchers will be looking at these data and saying, that they suggest that there is research to be done, and that it's fertile ground to plow to get some useful information.
I mean, I think one of the things that was useful I think with the therapies and the newer therapies that have come online is that the side effects associated with them are much less than in previous, and then the burden on the individual is also less. And so I think that gives them an opportunity to take them at higher CD4 counts than it was previously, right? And so there's also a lot of, certainly we've, our group has been involved in this debate, and I think there'll be, new guidelines will probably come out soon that will provide information on that as well. So who knows over the next few years what will happen in terms of that. But our data does suggest to some extent, but it was never written with that goal in mind.
What's the next step in your research, Bob? What are you working on? Can you tell us anything about that?
Well, I think what I'd like to do is to work with, at least I think that it may not be me, but there'll be individuals that will want to look at comparing people in ARTCC with ARTLINK in terms of life expectancy, so people in high versus low-income countries. And I think there would also be an opportunity to look at the impact of various causes of death on life expectancy as well. So that would be two interesting questions that would be useful from this collaboration.
All right. Well, Professor Bob Hogg, thank you so much for spending the time with us today.
Well, thank you very much. It was nice to talk to you.
Finally this week, the Wall Street Journal reports that light pollution from our cities is obscuring the night sky to an alarming degree. This is not only disappointing to people with telescopes, but it also robs us of the ability to look up and see how ridiculously small we are in the universe, that thing lurking on the other side of the obscuring haze. As Richard and Linda Thompson say, shoot out the lights. If you'd like to talk about any of this, or anything else, call 617-440-4374. Just leave your name and number so I can get back to you and get your permission to put your comments on the podcast. Story links are available at podcasts.jwatch.org. Included there, you'll also find links to previous podcasts in this series. Thanks for listening. For the Journal Watch podcast, I'm Joe Elia.